strike to that.
Copyright.
That's way too much.
Would they hit us with that for me? Yes, karaokeing Brandy.
Yes.
They're don't not even gonna say let her karaoke name. Karaoke Brandy.
Nope. Nope. Not at all.
Oh my god. So you're telling me I got to save all the Brandy karaoke for the champagne room?
That is what I'm telling you.
Oh. Why are they making us keep karaoke behind a paywall? You know what?
They're that's haters.
It's racism. Greetings, I'm your host Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of this the Revolution Podcast. So glad to have you guys here with us tonight for what should be a very interesting episode about the recent banking collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and the bailout of Credit Suisse.
Take your time with it.
Before we start, if you're new to the channel and you're enjoying what you're seeing, please hit like, subscribe, and the notification bell so you're alerted whenever we go live. We're constantly adding new shows and cross streams with other channels. Speaking of new shows, we had another installment of our White Guy Wednesday with Deep State Cuba, Mean Gene Bajlan, and the C. Derek Varn. The guys got into a deep dive discussion with Sublation Media's Doug Lane about the importance or the non-importance of the Twitter files and freedom of speech. It's up now, so when you're done with this show, please go check it out. Also, this past Tuesday, we had a guest flake on us. But the show must and always does go on. We had a great discussion about hip-hop and the Black political class, so definitely check that one out as well. For those of you that are subscribers and patrons, thank you for your continued support. That is the fuel in the engine of the TIR machine. If you listeners that are not patrons would like to have access to champagne rooms past and present, be part of the live audience for the Mau Mau Hour with Pascal Robert, and of course the TIR movie nights. There's only one way: become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the whole year. It can all be yours. So let's bring in some very important people. That voice you hear but never see, unless you were at the New York live show, maybe you thought you saw her. I still think that's so funny, Toussaint, that this dude was like, I want to meet Toussaint. And you were like standing next to him. You were waiting when I was trying to get you to go, you know, to the green room downstairs. And I was like, oh, she was like literally right behind you. And he's like, what? You kidding me? What? Like, I don't know what they think you're supposed to look like, but that lovely voice you hear, the chuckle that makes my day, M. Toussaint. Please welcome M. Toussaint.
Hello, hello, everyone. Going to have a good show today.
I hope we have a good show today. I know I'm going to have a good show when I got my homie, my dog, the man of the Mau Mau Hour, who was just recently a guest on the Serious Talk radio show Inside the Issues with Wilmer Leon. Please welcome the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. Peace and greetings, M2 Sun.
Yo. Now,
we are doing a cross stream with the sometimes why the TIR family. You could have met this gentleman if you were at the LA Live show. He is someone I feel very comfortable calling a friend. He rode in the car with me while blasting insane heavy metal music, driving in ridiculous speeds down I-5 in my Hyundai. Please welcome the very serious Derek Varn.
Hello. I'm trying to replace Nouriel Roubini as Dr. Doom. So,
wow.
And that's a economics deep cut joke.
Did you write the Black Swan?
No, that's Nassim Taleb. Nouriel Roubini was the guy who predicted 2007 and 2005. He's one of the only post-Keynesian mainstream economists who was on it. And he's been concerned for a while about this stuff, and so have I. So I'm just trying to steal his mantle, but I'm not a banker or an economist. But as we're learning, that maybe it's better not to be an economist when you talk about economics. Right.
Well, I want to dive right into this because we only have a limited time before we go to the champagne room. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. Many of you may have heard recently that Silicon Valley Bank, a small regional bank that many of you had probably never heard of before, collapsed. A bank where many of its customers had extremely large deposits and large online media personas as well. Unlike 2008, where we heard about people living outside their means and acting irresponsibly, we're seeing wealthy people on social media asking for regulation and recompense. Is this something we should be happy about for the left? Can we ride the anger of the 1% to more financial regulation, or maybe even something as insane as a bailout for American people? Or will we be drawn into a, quote, Big Short type of story where it simply becomes true crime drama that we tune into, like the recent murder trial in South Carolina? Today, we're going to have a deep dive conversation about why this crash is important and why we should care about financial regulation and deregulation. First and foremost, let's get some context out of the way. Can one of you briefly explain what happened in 2008 and what Dodd-Frank was designed to do? What is Dodd-Frank and what was it designed to do?
Well, 2008, you saw a toxic asset bomb due to what I will say was lack of general profitability after the dot-com bubble exploded in 2001. There's an increasing use of complicated financial instruments to collateralize really bad debt decisions. And to compound that, it was also aimed at Black and brown communities in specific, because they were subprimed by what we could kind of think of as like unofficial redlining. I worked in insurance in 2003, and I used to notice this, the rates in certain areas, because, and it was actuarial. There wasn't like a racist running the whole thing, but actuarial decisions were made that pretty much put a whole lot of people who shouldn't have been into subprime categories for their home loans anyway. They were collateralized as debt options, and basically everyone was just hoping that they would never blow up, and they started to blow up. Now, how does that relate to banking? Well, these complicated collateralized debt options are actually really hard to figure out, and when you started having shorting on these options, the banks basically didn't have money. We almost had a total freeze up of the banking system, particularly when AIG started to collapse. Yeah, everyone knows about Bear Stearns. AIG comes next. When AIG goes under, which is an important thing to think about. AIG was insuring these, like an additional, these were additional insurance for these stock businesses. Then you started seeing banking runs, and the biggest one was Washington Mutual, which is still the largest FDIC bailout of a bank in history. And you started seeing little banks being increasingly monopolized because the Obama administration, in its wisdom, really did kind of shit the bed. And when they did that, they kind of created a situation where they were willing to save the banks. Obama immediately backed off on his initial campaign promises to protect the subprime holders. And he got, you know, the Rescue Act through. Dodd-Frank was supposed to be a consumer and federal protection act. Now, there's a long history of this. I mean, part of this is the Reagan-Clinton deregulations anyway, particularly the regulations that have been passed priorly on the savings and loan scandals in 1983. The savings and loan scandal, I think, is actually a closer analogy to what's happening now, but we'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. Even though the cause of it is actually the opposite trend on bonds, but it still kind of is similar to what is going on now, I think. The reason why this is kind of a big deal is Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform had something called the Volcker Rule. And I think it's ironic that it was Paul Volcker who suggested this rule, given that the other part of our problem today is people trying to recapitulate Volcker policies. So Obama proposed the rule, the Volcker Rule, in 2009. It was scheduled to be implemented in the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010, but it was delayed. It was delayed until 2013. So you already see that the Democrats were hesitant to even invoke it. And what is the Volcker Rule? Volcker really thought that speculative activity played a key role in the financial crisis, which, duh. And so he wanted a ban on proprietary trading by commercial banks, where deposits are used on to trade on the bank's own accounts. Although even with this rule and Dodd-Frank, there's a laundry list of exceptions to this. When this was finally implemented in 2015, right at the end of the Obama administration, immediately many of the large banks requested a 5-year delay on its implementation anyway. And then Trump passed the Economic Growth Regulatory Relief and Consumer Protection Act, which partly reversed Dodd-Frank. Now, what was Dodd-Frank aimed to do? Dodd-Frank was aimed to increase bank transparency, shore up liquidity so it wouldn't freeze up anymore, and make lending more conservative. And by conservative, I just mean like they're not credit instruments are don't have all these time bombs.
So not as risky.
Yeah. And we do see that, for example, that still has an effect in housing, right? So, for example, the United States is almost all fixed rate mortgages, and that's going to lead to some really weird wealth inequity in the future, just based on when you bought your house. But that's another thing. Even the Europe, which has lower rates on their, you know, lower interest rates on their mortgages, does not have the same kind of fixed rate mortgages we do. between the original housing acts in the early 20th century and the rules that were passed around Dodd-Frank, not necessarily in Dodd-Frank. But the Volcker Rule is the first thing that was gone. So what that was designed to do was get people, you know, get kind of risky speculative elements out of the banks. Now, here's the thing. Not only is it barely was ever actually upheld, like we talked about, it was basically law for 3 years. It was completely reversed by 2020. And the argument was that it would protect the, you know, consumers. It would protect also the Fed from having to do massive bailouts. I don't know, honestly, if it really would have worked, because what began this chain is Silvergate. And we haven't talked about Silvergate, but Silvergate's weird. Silvergate was one of the only banks that was explicitly tied into crypto markets through a very complicated use of regulated loopholes. And all of crypto was regulated loopholes. That's what crypto was for, was regulated. It was to be deflationary, and it was designed to be deflationary inherently. So deflationary actually doesn't work as a currency.
Well, hold on for a second, because I think we're jumping around just a little bit here. So how does crypto fit into what's going on with Silicon Valley Bank?
Okay. Directly, it doesn't. Okay. However, the industries that are tied into Silicon Valley Bank were also heavily tied into crypto. So it is not surprising that part of the concern and the audit that led people to start feeling like they needed to pull their money out of Silicon Valley Bank happened after Silvergate failed. So the first bank in this loop in California was Silvergate. It was a small, it was an actually small regional bank. Silicon Valley Bank is weird. It is technically a small bank, but it was the 17th largest in asset holdings.
Well, Silicon Valley Bank is interesting. That's the reason why I wanted us to have some sort of context on why it is, why we care about a small regional bank out of a small part of California, is that it was part of deregulation that allowed it to be able to be a venture capital lender as well. Without
that started all the way back in the Clinton years. So, I mean, one of the things about Silicon Valley Bank is like there weren't that many like individuals who had bank accounts there. So it's interesting. But what I've been reading a whole lot on the regulatory effects here, and it's unclear if the Volcker Rule would have helped, because there's supposed to be audits of these kinds of banks anyway by the FDIC and the Fed, and that wasn't happening. So
you mind if I interject? One of the things that I wanted to get to hit on, because you're talking about Dodd-Frank, the Volcker Rule, I was pretty much covering this period of time pretty consistently for Black Agenda Report, and several things I think were very important to realize is that at the time that Dodd-Frank was being proposed, and even afterwards passed, the universal consensus, even amongst some centrist voices amongst Democrats, was that this was absolutely weak sauce as far as legislation was concerned, and compared to the absolute carnage that had been done in the subprime mortgage crisis in 2007-2008. And let's not forget that actually the number of hundreds of billions of dollars that were given over to the financial services industry that were bailed out, you know, in spite of their concern for a moral hazard, which is a term to basically say that if you support financial institutions when they go down in a free market capitalist society, you're creating a moral situation in which they will become lax and unable to govern themselves because they can depend on the state to protect them. Despite the rhetoric of moral hazard, we had, you know, the complete bailout of the banks. One of the things when you were mentioning Obama that is very important is that people failed to realize that Barack Obama in his administration comes into his administration with people who are direct members of the Citigroup Bank that come out of the former Secretary of Treasury that Bob Rubin, that was part of the deregulatory regime under the Clinton administration. So Obama, who is an acolyte of a man named Michael Froman, Michael Froman was very good friends with Bob Rubin's son, went to law school with Obama, was on Harvard Law School with Obama, introduces Obama to Bob Rubin before he's president. And literally Obama comes into the White House as an acolyte and a student and appreciator of Robert Rubin, probably one of the most nefarious Secretary of Treasuries in the history of the United States. And with Michael Froman as one of his chief forces, deciding his administrative team. Don't forget, it came out after Obama left office that one of the biggest secrets that was revealed from Clinton's emails was not about Hillary, but it was that Michael Froman was choosing all of Obama's administrative team as a Citibank executive. And what happens when Obama becomes president? Citibank gets massive amounts of bailouts and gets no repercussions at all whatsoever. And when Obama comes into office, what happens when he's confronted with the banks? He tells them, and this is covered in the book, Confidence Man, I'm here to protect you from the pitchforks.
Yep, that's what I was implying, is that pitchfork speech. Well, I mean, let's talk about, like, Dodd-Frank versus, say, its historical predecessor, Glass-Steagall. You know, Glass-Steagall's passed in 1933, basically to prevent... it's part of what begins the New Deal banking reforms. It calls for a separation of commercial investment from securities and investment banks from taking deposits, and the commercial Federal Reserve member banks from dealing in non-governmental securities, investing in non-investment grade securities for themselves. Underwriting or distributing non-governmental securities, are affiliating our sharing employees with companies to do such activities. But it's important to remember that we talk about Clinton. Clinton finally stabbed Glass-Steagall as one of the last things that he did in 1999. All right.
Very important. Can we talk about how Glass-Steagall is a financial regulatory measure going back to the New Deal?
Yeah, it's basically the beginnings of the New Deal.
That literally was designed to separate commercial banking and financial institutional banking from retail banking and stop the normal mom and pop banking from being correlated with financial risky banking. And so you could not literally have things like JP Morgan Chase coming back and controlling mom and dad's savings money and then taking it to buy securitized assets, which is exactly what Clinton did when he deregulated Glass-Steagall and allowed one type of bank, which is your investment banks, to start to influence and merge with normal retail or commercial banks. And that's what stripping Dodd-Steagall did. And let's also talk about when Clinton signed the Commodities Futures and Modernization Act and what the consequence was of that as well.
Yeah, that's a disaster. I do want to put a little bit of caveat here, because the Democrats have been snipping at Glass-Steagall through the Office of Comptroller of the Currency since the 1960s. So they were shadow deregulating it by administrative interpretations all the way back to JFK. And I think one of the interesting things about JFK, if we're really honest, is he's kind of a precursor to neoliberalism in a lot of ways. LBJ kind of puts a stop to that. Then in the 1980s, you start getting talks to repeal certain provisions of Glass-Steagall, specifically sections 20 and 32. This is kind of stalled by the savings and loans crisis. So Reagan doesn't really completely get it done, and they just kind of, what they actually do is you know, weaken the regulatory agencies within, you know, within them, within the agencies themselves. But in 1999, you have a bipartisan bill called the Graham-Leach-Bailey Act, which are the Financial Services Modernization Act, which basically completely guts Glass-Steagall. It's bipartisan because while it is a Republican bill, Bill Clinton doesn't do anything about it. One of the things that happens then, I mean, it's interesting because we always talk about the too big to fail. It's in the debates around this where the phrase actually gets started to be thrown around, that the Financial Services Act of 1999 would create banks that were so big that if they failed, they would not just affect the U.S. economy, but the world economy, thus putting the Fed and the FDIC on the line in a way that they are not supposed to be.
All right. Ron, can you tell us who the Secretary of Treasury was at the time and who was Chairman of the Federal Reserve?
Oh, Federal Reserve. Is that Greenspan? I believe it's Greenspan.
Alan Greenspan.
Yep. Who was, you know, our Darth Lord of the Treasury Reserve for a long time. Mm-hmm. Only really gotten rid of in the lead up to 2007. Secretary of the Treasury, I'm blanking on that.
It was Robert Rubin.
Oh, I knew it's Rubin. Okay. Another Dark Lord.
Literally Obama's Darth Sith mentor.
Why is Robert Rubin an important character to you, Pascal?
Because Robert Rubin was the ideological force behind deregulation in the Clinton administration, and Robert Rubin has been able to protect his very, very nefarious and corrupt ability to destroy financial institutions in American capitalism and receive government largesse to protect his assets and be completely unscathed. He is, without a doubt, in my opinion, allegedly one of the most corrupt Secretary of Treasuries in American history.
So Rubin really does begin something. Like, Rubin's the continuity between the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. And I remember when they appointed him, I felt like an idiot for ever helping Obama get elected. By the way, it's the only time in my life I've ever voted for a Democrat. Beyond that, the thing about that we need to really pay attention to is the Delaware laxity on financial services, and that's literally almost manifested in the droopy personage of Sleepy Joe Biden. And what Rubin did really changed the political alliances of a lot of the large banks. All right, so one of the things that we have an issue with the Democrats now, we just have to be honest about it, is the two sectors that are going to be the biggest problem in this, the dot-coms are what we call tech, and by that I mean IP-seeking companies, venture capital, etc. And the banks are the bourgeois part of the Democrats' voter base. I mean, by voter base, I really mean their donor base, but yes, they also vote for them. And that includes why the Democrats have been so quiet, both on a state and federal level, about shit like crypto, despite some people in the progressive circles really pushing for its regulation. One of the reasons I keep on bringing up crypto is crypto was the beginnings of the signs that this was a too lax, and there were other things going on, because there's a whole nother back end of this. We're talking about deregulation, but the removal of moral hazard led to a couple of things, which was a focus on what we can see as unproductive investment. So you start seeing investment more and more being these weird financial assets because they have high yields, et cetera. And you start seeing because there's so much money coming from this asset inflation, you start seeing it doesn't have anywhere to go, and they don't want to invest it in like traditional, you know, manufacturing, at least not directly. So you start seeing weird financial instruments come around. But crypto, which was supposed to be like an alternative libertarian coinage that was like gold, because it was deflationary, became a way around these regulations. All right. So that's another issue here, is there is this whole market that opened up that at first was supposed to be like, you know, weirdos to use crypto to buy illegal stuff, and libertarians do it because hoarding gold is not as profitable as it used to be. So what do? We make a hyper deflationary e-coin that, you know, uses a lot of power and is very hard and easy to steal, but very hard to actually do much with. And for a while, it doesn't catch on. Then you start seeing, and the reason why it doesn't catch on is because banks don't want to touch it. Why do banks not want to touch it? Because of the very security things that we're talking about. You can't prove that it wasn't acquired through crime, and thus it opens banks up to all kinds of money laundering acts. What starts to change around 2014-2015 is stable coins, which are a way to do exchanges of crypto and things that you're supposed to be able to get to dollars, and these kind of weird bank transaction instruments that enable you to like use a mediator to get crypto into like another form and then get that into dollars. So you can valorize it without, you know, in other ways than spending it. This turns crypto into an investing instrument. And that's when you see it really pop off. And that's when you see all the crypto scams. But what makes that possible is all this money that people are not putting into traditional like forms of capital investment, because the profit margins aren't good enough, unless you're like in the developing world. And if you're in the developing world, the profit margins are really good, but the risk is super high. So that's what you start to see happen. So now, this means that one of the interesting things about the Silicon Valley stuff is we've already seen that these conditions, when you add a third thing that happened, and I know my MMT friends get mad at me when I talk about this, but it was QE. QE led to asset inflation.
Quantitative easing.
Can we debrief, explain what is quantitative easing? What is the purpose of quantitative easing? Why the Federal Reserve engages in it? How it affects this whole scenario?
So quantitative easing was something began in Japan that is based off something that banks already do. What is called market operations or normal market operations. And what that means is the Fed has to hit like a certain target of inflation around the money supply. And it does that by buying and selling bonds to itself. All right. What quantitative easing does is it starts encouraging the Fed to buy back bonds from private businesses to eat up bad debt. So what it does, it's like, now the way they said it was supposed to work was to increase liquidity in the market. What is interesting is it doesn't have a lot of effect on the money supply. So quantitative easing didn't change the standard 2-3% inflation in the overall market, right? Why? Because it didn't really increase the money supply for the average person. But what it did do is make really stupid investments possibly profitable off of leveraging the difference between bonds and those bonds being bought back and debt. All right. And so, my friends, this whole tech ecosphere that you've developed, it all developed really conspicuously, I don't know, around 2010, 2011. Have you not asked yourself questions about why that happened? It's not like we didn't have the internet for 20 fucking years at that point. it's a very important thing to look at. Now, what that led to is also why the stock market quit making any fucking sense. Like the stock market, what normally would trip off bear markets no longer tripped off bear markets. And in fact, I've actually, a friend of mine, Nico Villarreal at Casper Forums, and I have been talking a lot about this because we both believed we were heading into recession at the end of 2019. And we both think that the QE dump that was massive, it's the biggest QE dump the world has ever seen, happened and starved off that, starved off the market going crazy and dipping and thus bringing about a recession. The other thing it helped is that the U.S. started doing Fordist policies again, even under Trump, which the scholar Robert Brenner actually says one of the reasons Trump got so weird is like he has to appeal to a group of people who don't believe in that. And yet the policies he was adopting were working. So, you know, he started talking about bullshit like hydrochloroquine. But it's important to realize that, like, there's a continuity there. You had all this bottled demand, though, happening. And then we had massive monopolizations because all this QE, which is being dumped into the market kind of generically, keeping the stocks up. What did people do with that? You started seeing massive purchasing of stuff at fire sales to keep it from going under during the pandemic. And then you also started seeing massive purchasing of homes as investment properties.
Mark, can you also talk about how we also started seeing massive stock buybacks from corporations using this liquidity to buy their own shares to increase their own market value?
Yeah, stock buybacks have become a bigger and bigger thing since the 1990s.
So are you talking specifically during the Trump tax cuts before the?
No, we're talking specifically during COVID, because COVID,
the pandemic
was the largest increase on the 1% wealth that we have seen ever. Mm-hmm. Ever. All right. And it's because most of the things used to stabilize the economy, while there were downstream benefits, really stabilize things for asset holders who could then use their assets that were inflated to buy more assets. Mm-hmm. This is the rational part of the weird paranoia out of the Great Reset. All right. This really happens. Now, Trump tax cuts already set a precedent for this environment, but this really happens when you add those all those conditions with massive amounts of QE. Now, why does this lead to inflation? Well, because the people are basically hoarding these assets, right? And they're buying up more and more stuff. You see these massive, like, monopolization trends get even more monopoly-ish. Now,
well, didn't we have some inflation during the pandemic, during the shelter in place?
We had a little bit, but the inflation in shelter in place was initially related to resource depletion. So what you started seeing there was actual, like, the supply chain really broke down. It really was temporary supply and demand shocks. However, it very quickly became what you could call predictive inflation price ranges, which we should just call what they are, and that's price gouging. So,
Mark, can I interject if you don't mind?
Yeah.
Can we talk about how the quantitative easing, which we've already demonstrated, creates a type of liquidity that allows the financial services industry and the asset class, which are the capitalist class, to circulate bonds amongst themselves to increase value of these, not only these instruments, but these institutions, is pretty much a way in which the Federal Reserve, using quantitative easing, is creating the illusion of a recovery while Main Street is getting nothing but gig economy jobs. And is, you know, literally under Obama's presidency, we saw 90% of his job growth were literally low-wage temp jobs. That's a fact. You can research that. But combine that, another factor, another poison pill here, is close to zero or zero interest rates. Can we talk about how insanely low interest rates help fuel this illusion of a recovery and also create something called the parity trade, where financial institutions are borrowing money as from the Federal Reserve at close to 0% interest rate and selling them and loaning money internationally to other institutions in other parts of the world that have a higher interest rate and literally profiting off the loans between the low interest rates? So you would borrow money from the Fed at close to zero and say you can lend money in Israel because Israel has a 3% interest rate. So the financial services industry is using the parity trade to cake off all these Fed policies after one of the biggest crashes in American history, plus all this deregulation, while we are still seeing Main Street being ground to dust from the crisis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is why we had a, quote, slow growth recovery, a top-down recovery. Why? During the time period of the Democratic Socialist, I'm going to put a lot of things in quotation marks so you can get how I actually feel about it, grew in response to that, while inequity just kept ballooning. And the reason why is everything moved into this. But this is also why, guys, I've been talking to a lot of people, like, why does the bourgeoisie seem to be out to lunch? Why are you guys so concerned about the managers? Because where's the fucking bourgeoisie? This is why they aren't around. They're so tied up into these kinds of trades and finance stuff, they don't need to invest in shit. So all the prior investments in education and infrastructure, the reason why the industrial capitalists did that wasn't out of the kindness of their hearts. They were actually offloading costs of training onto the state. But it really did benefit people to do that. You started seeing schools, you started seeing infrastructure built. It's because that shit's too expensive even for those firms to do, and the state can do it because the state has, particularly a large state like the United States, has currency sovereignty. It can do a lot of that. Now, one of the other things that I think, Pascal, we have to talk about is that during this time period, the left started celebrating 0% interest rates.
MMT, baby.
Yeah. That's what, you know, like, I agree with a lot of the stuff in MMT, but MMT, there's a weird couple of things that are doctrinal to MMT that I don't understand. And one of them is, like, the natural interest rate is 0%. My friends, there's no such thing as a natural interest rate. Mm-hmm. Bankings don't occur in fucking nature. But anyway, the point about this is that there was nobody opposing these low interest rates. Now, I'm just going to explain why this is bad during this time period. It makes acquisition of massive amounts of capital really easy. And when it goes away, right, things start to spiral out of control when you start seeing these price hikes and this monopolization. But there's no move to break anything up. Nobody's invoking antitrust laws right now. All right. Probably because we kind of know that these small business conditions are really bad, and there'd be a tendency back towards monopoly anyway.
So, right? Vaughn, we're in the last 15 minutes. Let's sum it in. Can you now bring it home for us and explain how the combination of dependency on quantitative easing, close to zero interest rates, and the rise of inflation, and the Fed deciding to now raise interest rates and slow quantitative easing create the perfect storm that lead to these bank collapses?
Well, basically, you have a whole lot of assets that were based off of these trades off of cheap debt, right? Sometimes it's called easy money. I think we should really call what it is, it's cheap debt. And so during this time period, you could take on a lot of debt, but take on even relatively low yield bonds and outstrip them. Now you might go, well, why is the bond market becoming toxic? That's a good question. Good question indeed. Why is supposedly the safest And this is why I think we should talk about some things that should really scare people. Why is supposedly the safest form of investment that we have becoming toxic when the interest rate goes up and thus the payout on new bonds is higher? Ooh. Well, that's because the old bonds are now liabilities. And it also means that people who were storing money into these bank accounts and not into the market, because people are afraid that, and we don't understand exactly why the market still hasn't crashed. It is starting to, we've seen weakness in the last 2 years, but we haven't seen any like super huge crashes outside of when COVID hit at first. Here's what we have to look at. So we're looking at this and we're thinking, okay, now in the past, the toxic asset was subprime mortgages. It's an asset bomb. It's a big problem. It affects everybody because of housing. It even affects renters. There's no one who isn't affected by it. But it really isn't that systemic. By that, I meant it really was you fix the mortgage market, it goes away. Now, the way we fixed it, if you care about stuff like the racial wealth gap and median racial wealth, you know what a lot of that is? Housing policy shit. Once you get rid of the super rich, like most of it's tied into housing policy. But beyond that, let's really like look at what this means. So you are holding a low yield bond. It's really low yield. The new bond's really high yield. You have to, what are you going to do? You're going to sell that bond because taking the loss in its maturity is worth it to go use the money to buy a higher yield bond. All right. So that makes those, but it makes those old bonds that are held in mass, particularly at places like Silicon Valley Bank, toxic. And they were using this to offset the fact that all of their investors were, and a lot of their bank holders were these tech firms that were venture capital tech firms. Now let's talk about what venture capital tech firms are. Venture capital tech firms are not profitable by definition. The idea is you dump tons of capital in them until they become profitable, or until you get a federal contract that backstops them, like, you know, Amazon services or, you know, whatever. And which is why all your super rich people right now, if you're looking at individuals, if you look at families, you actually see something very, very different, and it hides a whole lot. You know, like the new rich are the only people you see on the top end of the 400 or 500, except for Warren Buffett. But beyond that, if you really look at this and like think about, okay, the people are holding these bonds, they're using these bonds to make these really sketchy transactions secure, and they could do that. And the other reason they could do that is something called marked to market. Marked to market means, that actually means the opposite of what it says. It means you can mark your valuation of your assets at the value of which when you purchased them, not the value of their current market value. So all these reports that you're seeing on forward for all these fiscal assets are based off mark to market. So they're based off the value of when they were made, not what they are if they were sold right now. You can see, if you can do that, that's a problem. Now, between the Treasury bonds becoming toxic, people started going, I don't know that Silicon Valley Bank has the money to do this. And so the investors start talking amongst each other and to do a bank run. Now, we tend to pretend that bank runs are animal spirits or some shit. It is not. This was totally rational. Like, it's irrational in aggregate, but it's actually rational for each one of these businesses to do it. Because, oh my God, this bank isn't making enough money. It's having to sell off a ton of assets because these bonds are a liability. And it doesn't have deposits. Let's talk about why it doesn't have deposits with these high-yield bonds. If you're a saver, one of the whole theories, we haven't talked about the Fed and all this, and the Fed is looming very scarily because they're about to destroy us all. But the Fed, one of these things with low interest rates is like, it does encourage people to either invest in the market, like the market. Now, we're not investing in a lot of stuff that's traditionally building like old school industrial capital stuff. That's not what they're investing in. But beyond that, it does ensure them to dump money into the market. And it encourages people to regular old people or small other people to keep emergency savings in a savings account, even though the yields are super low. One of the fascinating things about right now that proves that the Volcker logic that they had in the 80s is bullshit, and Jay Powell knows it, is that traditionally one of the things that raising the federal rates is supposed to do is also raise the return on savings accounts in commercial banks. Why? Because, well, these bonds are more valuable. They have to compete with the bonds, but also they have more money because they can collect more interest on things, so they can pay that back to their depositors. At below the bond rate, but significantly. That never happened this time. It hasn't happened anywhere on earth. The returns in the savings account are still super, super low. So what are the people are going to do? If they're not going to put it in the market, it's going to make treasury bonds worth a lot more money. But all these old treasury bonds that the banks are holding, well, you got, like, people are going to want, and that they've sold, people are going to want to cash them out to buy the new treasury bonds and pull their deposits out to save with treasury bonds because they have 4% yields as opposed to like 0.5 or 0.7 or 0.2 or whatever you're getting in a savings account. Maybe 1%.
So what you're saying is that the rise in interest rates, because it affects the value of bonds, is going to push people to dump the old bonds, because when you buy those bonds, they're fixed at the low rate because they can get a higher return on newly issued bonds, and those that the banks that are holding those old bonds are basically holding worthless debt, because a bond is literally a debt. You're buying debt and making money from the interest you get from the bond. And since the banks are holding that old debt that is now pretty much worthless because people want to sell it and get higher interest, now you're going to have a large number of banks, due to higher interest rates, have basically worthless equity. And this is what's helping cause so many banks in the current banking sector, because don't forget, banks are traded in the securities industry. And if you look at their values, if you watch the Wall Street markets, their values have been dropping consistently for the last 3 or 4 days.
Can I ask, mm-hmm. What does this mean for the regular person? Do I need to run on a bank?
If you run on a bank, you're going to make things worse.
I'm going to make things worse. Like, you know, It's a Wonderful Life. More people trying to run on the bank and take their money out is going to cause crashes.
Right. And the other thing is, do you have more than $250,000 in a singular bank account?
I do.
Oh.
Well, okay.
Yeah, maybe you should take the money that you have in that singular bank account, over $250,000, and put it in a second bank account.
Second bank account. Not my mattress. Don't put it in my mattress.
Don't put it in your mattress. I think people are talking to me with mark to market. It's not mark. I think I got the terms confused. So I wanted to respond to that. So I think it's parity accounting and not mark to market.
Don't worry about it.
But anyway,
it doesn't exist. There you go.
Kind of important. But should you be afraid? Yes, you should be afraid, but not of your money in the bank.
Okay.
What you should be afraid about is that we're learning. When I first looked at this on just Saturday, okay, I went. I went to bed hearing that the market was spooked because we were about to see another hike because employment is too good, all right? Because the Fed has just said that it's doing the Volcker shock, not for the reasons why they did the Volcker shock in the 1970s, which was to encourage people to put stuff in the savings accounts, remove it from overheated markets, encourage banks to be more selective in their lending, but to slowly accumulate stuff in reinvestment, because that's not what happened in the 1980s, and it's definitely not what's happening now. They decided to do the same thing, but with the idea that employment is the problem, that the raise in pay corresponding with inflation even though Pei has never at any point caught up with more with inflation at all. And at most, I've even seen conservative economists say that it was at most 1% of the cause of inflation. And that's in the way they figure it, not the way I do. But at no point was there ever a real threat of wages being that. What they're worried about is that now that things have turned against immigration, and that seems politically unviable even for Democrats, and they can't use that to cheapen the low end of labor. The only way to cheapen the low end of labor is to discipline labor as a whole. And that led to things like tech sector layoffs. Now, tech sector layoffs don't seem rational. All right. They don't seem rational because the layoffs don't return profitability. They are actually pretty costly in severance packages, et cetera, because we're dealing with a class of worker that is entitled to that. But what they do is spike market value on the stock market. All right. So whenever people lay off, there is an investment turn and stocks tend to go up. And then they hire back. So a lot of these tech companies were hiring some of the people back. But that also disciplines the market because everybody hates those dirty PMC tech people and how good they have it with their fun rooms and their at-homeness. And so what that actually does, though, is that they're hoping to, well, you have a bunch of highly skilled people dumped into the regular labor market. Now, I don't think that the tech firms aren't thinking this, but the Fed is thinking this.
What's really important here, Varun, is that you're admitting something, which is very important, because I actually had a friend of mine, who's a good friend of mine, who works in the financial services industry, former Federal Reserve employee, knows federal banking and finance well. And I told him, once interest rates started going up, and I was watching this, and I've mentioned this on the show before, I said, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates to discipline labor. And he completely denied it. He said, no, I don't think it's the case. And I was like, you know, what's really fascinating here is that literally the Fed chairman admitted publicly that one of the main reasons that they've been raising the rates is that they want to be able to discipline labor.
Yeah, they've said it outright that they need to increase the unemployment rate, that will lower costs because the cost of labor is supposedly what is driving the inflation, even though they know that's not true. They know it's not true. All right. That this is not this is. And you know how we know that true? A bunch of documents got leaked by Janet Yellen.
By the way, back to M. Toussaint asking, well, how does this affect the average working man? Because the Federal Reserve, which is not a government institution, quasi-government. The Federal Reserve is a consortium of private banks in which the head is chosen by the federal government or the president. It is a consortium of private banks. It is a quasi-government institution at best. It is literally deciding we want to raise interest rates to, yes, help fight inflation, but to basically cause people to lose their jobs because we believe they have too much money.
Yeah, and by the way, the inflation index that the Fed uses doesn't include food, doesn't include housing, and doesn't include energy. You have to look at separate inflation indexes that correct and add that back in. Just want you guys to know that. And which is why, by the way, like the inflation index was at like 2 or 3% was always kind of bullshit because we've had inflation, not in food, actually. Food has been historic. Food is really volatile. And so it tends to be cheap until it's not. But in housing and education and in healthcare, we've had massive inflation for 3 decades. We don't care about that because that effects aren't really affecting the high end of the market. This is actually a good question. I think is actually correct. Go ahead.
Okay. JB sends a super chat. Varn, isn't Fed also raising interest rates to reduce inflation to stabilize US dollar? Because it needs to be stable as global reserve currency, or other economies like EU get screwed by inflation, to hence the bind we're in.
So one thing you have to talk about with the EU is the EU doesn't have currency sovereignty on its own because of laws in the EU constitution. So there's like there are restrictions, I think, of a certain percentage amount. I think it's like 2 or 3% in the EU constitution that bars them doing certain kinds of financial things to like increase liquidity in their markets. However, people might be asking, Varn, why the fuck is Credit Suisse not some American bank the next thing to fall in this chain? That's a good question. And it's sort of tied into this. So the inflation problem, we're already seeing the EU. If you looked at the percentage of the world reserve currencies, that's like euros and pounds, that's going down dramatically. The dollar's actually fared where. There's been a lot of left economists that I respect who've been predicting an imminent dollar die-off that hasn't happened. I've been betting against them this entire time, even though I think a lot of their other analysis is really good. But there's a real chance that if they don't get inflation under control, the dollar is going to be too expensive for people to keep as a reserve currency. And that's a problem. All right, because if you're the hegemon, yeah, and yes, we're still the second most industrial productive economy. We're totally tied into China, although that's decoupling right now, and it's going to continue to decoupling. Sorry, TikTok users, it's another day. But there's a real issue here. If you look at this in like a long durée sense. And this is going to be a bomb for the average person in our economy. On one hand, there's a need to decouple and go into regional trade zones. That's what multipolarity means, all right? And that might even good for that. I want to actually say something. I think in a geopolitical sense, multipolarity is a risky strategy, but it's inevitable. But in a financial sense, for the average American, you know, worker, it might actually be a good thing, because you're going to see reshoring and tying up, you know, there'd be a lot of jobs that don't require high amounts of education, that don't require high amounts of debt, but are stable and not service sector jobs. All right. Well, we can't fucking have that, can we? All right. So on one hand, for our geopolitical goals, we have the need to reshore, work with other countries like India in a more collaborative way. This is all the Biden strategy. And on the other hand, they don't have enough workers for anything. And the Fed wants to discipline labor. I ask you, how the fuck are you going to reshore and discipline labor? And this is where things really get interesting for the Democrats. And this is a good point to kind of wrap this up on. One of the things that came out today is that, you know, the Democrats did this non-bailout bailout with the depositors who are all businesses in Silicon Valley, in the Silicon Valley Bank. It's not going to cost taxpayers through taxes, although let's be honest, they could have deficit funded this. It doesn't matter if it, like, they don't have to, it does it. That's not how this works unless things get really out of control. But one thing I will say is, no, they're going to add additional fees on banking, which you're going to pay. All right. That's another way it's going to affect you. It might not be super large, as most of you probably don't have a lot of money, but you're going to pay those fees. Money Penny over here, it got, you know, the faceless voice of the bourgeoisie. But that is going to be passed off to consumers. There's no way the banks are just going to eat that. And what else does it mean? Well, it means there's absolutely no moral hazard. Even conservative economists I linked to, well, a moderate economist I linked to out of the UK called Patrick Boyle, just said every risk management playbook that we've ever known just got thrown out of the water and pissed on. Like, this is an environment where there is no incentive now.
Is that a quote?
more or less.
I watched it. He did say that.
I think he didn't say the pissed on part, but although Patrick Bortles really funny, so he might have. I'm not beyond forgetting that I stole a phrase from somebody. So, but he was saying that risk management is going to be damn near impossible, right, in any of these things now, because we know it. And here's how we know the other problem. Okay, one thing that, the right has been hitting Democrats on that's accurate is all these weird crypto bros who used to be associated with libertarians, like weird libertarians, all they didn't even like Republicans because they didn't want to get rid of enough government, have totally switched over in the millennial generation to being Democrats. Mm-hmm. It's a good investment. Sam Bankman-Fried, a super, super fucking large donor to the Democrats and illegally.
Right.
Gavin Newsom, while I said that most people don't have bank accounts at Silicon Valley Bank, Gavin Newsom does. And he was lobbying Biden for this non-bailout bailout. So the problem here is the Democrats themselves, and Barney Frank. I mean, Barney Frank himself is in a bank that just went under. You see this spewing out. Now, the other thing I was mentioning with the Europeans, we talked about the Europeans are in financial trouble. We talked about how they're not, there's a reserve currency problem. Well, Switzerland isn't, you know, Swiss francs aren't euros. So what's going on there? They're highly tied into this. And because of those weird limitations I talked about on EU banking, and this, I know people are like, there's such a thing as bad regulation, my dudes. This is why we're not liberals. Like, we don't always go, we just need to throw some regulation at it. That's what the EU does. Well, the EU's capital security requirements and Switzerland's capital security requirements are really opaque and they're discretionary. So, sometimes, like the European Central Bank has pushed back on banks asking for less capital requirements in the Eurozone. I know Switzerland is not part of that, but they're tied into it intimately. Another thing that we're learning is, however, there's a lot of regulatory discretion in each individual country for how that's done. And no one really knows what their actual capital requirements and holdings really are in aggregate. So actually, the European banks are more fragile than a lot of the American ones. But once they start breaking, what do you think is going to happen to the American ones? And the other thing about this is, while there's not all this oversight on risk, there's another thing that happens right now. During the 07 time period, 07 to 09, big banks could go and like do this repo sellout and they get like loans for nothing. And they, you know, leverage it, do this, that, and the other. There were some reforms, though, that disadvantage small banks in this way. So small banks are less regulated. They're more able to get into these weird financial instruments, which is why Silicon Valley Bank is so weird. When they go to settle out, the Fed makes sure that their large bank holders, such as Bank of America, Morgan Chase, et cetera, get paid out first, thus increasing the monopolization tendency. Monopolization means monopsony pricing power. My friends, the more of that you have, the harder it is to fight inflation. And we know today, as my capstone for all this, European Central Bank just continue jacking up interest rates. And while Goldman Sachs are saying, we don't think the Fed is going to do that, every other bank has said, yes, they do. The market said, yes, they do, because there's markets on bets on this. Since the European Central Bank just did it, I almost promise you they're going to batten ahead. And you know what they're going to do? This is why you should be afraid about this right now. Not about your money in the bank. They're going to protect these banks and these investors and these Silicon Valley loons, but they're not going to protect everybody else. No. They're going to continue to raise the interest rates so that the high levels of credit card debt, by the way, credit card debt on individual households has gone through the roof, is going to continue sparking, and eventually we are going to have bankruptcy crises.
Well, what you guys have been hearing for the last 9 minutes is complimentary champagne from C. Derek Varn. Pascal Robert, you awake? You ready to go to the champagne room?
I was awake the whole time.
That like sounds like Pascal my father when he's memory. Just resting his eyes. Derek Varn, are you going to join us in the champagne room?
Of course I am. I'm going to.
You sure? You know, it's going to be pretty black in there in a little bit.
You fit right in.
I almost have Jerry curls right now.
We're gonna examine the reverse racism of the late Bobby Caldwell.
Oh my God! Are we gonna we gonna Mau Mau Blue Eyed Soul?
Oh yeah,
we love Blue Eyed Soul, man.
Hey, Bobby Caldwell was told not to show his face on his records. Sound familiar? Reverse dun, dun. Racism. Dun dun dun. Jesus Christ, how many people love the crack? Addicted to reverse racism. You were not expecting that one.
No, I was not.
Let us know what you think about this show in the comments, guys. If you agree with what's being said, if you have some disagreements, if you want us to go further with this, we might bring on an economist next week or in 2 weeks. Is next week Finkelstein?
Next week is Finkelstein.
Oh, then in 2 weeks. And then talk about this further because it's not over. Thank you, Varn, for joining us. Thank you to all the subscribers. Thank you to everyone that hit like.
Leave your money in the bank, please. No bank runs.
If you're not down for champagne and don't want to make that monthly or yearly commitment, you can show your support with TIR merch. Impress all your friends with this shirt, with the saying that they will have no idea what it means. Anglo-pessimism.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite. And I don't have one, sadly.
I do. That shirt is highly valued. In fact, I wore it, and my partner was like, I also want that shirt because I'm hanging out with you. This is like Anglo-pessimist, and then point over here with this one.
And you know what? I feel like is tomorrow St. Patrick's Day?
Yes, it is. No, Friday. That's right. It's tomorrow.
Okay. Jordan, I have to go up north tomorrow night because Saturday we're going to see my friend Todd, who plays in a band called Cyclone 9, not Zyklon B.
We had a discussion about whether or not they toured with Screwdriver.
Yeah, no.
Thank you, DPS.
No, they did not. So, Jordan, I'm wondering if we should meet up with Ben and have our, like we talked about doing, St. Patrick's Day in a very non-Irish city like St. Patrick's Day in San Isidro.
Or that would be San Patrico Day.
San Patrick. That might be fun.
Are we doing a movie night this month?
We have not done one yet.
Do you have any suggestions?
I already got my vote in.
She already has her vote in. Toussaint has not picked a movie night movie yet.
Haven't.
What does she want? Well, we discriminate against women when it comes to that.
That's true.
We discriminate against women for a lot of things. We're pretty horrible.
We do not, don't even admit that publicly because we do not discriminate.
Oh, I take it back.
What is the movie that M. Toussaint wants to watch?
Do you remember Jason?
Love Jones?
You said Love Jones!
You think I got a foot of ladies' choice? Get out of here.
Love Jones!
Love Jones. No, that's your choice. I chose 80 Blocks from Tiffany's.
80 Blocks from Tiffany's? What is that?
It's a documentary. Old school hip hop.
Oh, a hip hop! Another hip hop documentary?
This is a real hip hop documentary. This one was filmed at the time.
Kushluck says Gymkata. I've been pushing for Gymkata since day one.
What is Gymkata?
I'm gymnastics and karate.
Actually, gymnastics. Why don't we go old school? Let's watch a Bruce Lee movie, man. Five Deadly Venoms.
No, Gymkata. When it's not Bart Carner, it's Kurt Thomas is a secret spy that uses his U.S. Olympic gymnastics to fight off Russian terrorism.
Save me.
But he does it in this way that's so comical because he always happens to find gymnast shit in the most random places. Like he goes to the town square and there's a pommel horse just in it and he jumps on it and starts kicking all the bad guys. Yeah, it's insane. It's insane. Well, but hey, this is all champagne room talk. We will see you guys in the champagne room. Mm-hmm. And we are
black.
That too.